The clock on the wall says 6:30 past. We've just had a timely information repast. And next, you're the star, west side of the state. I'd be more than happy to illustrate. This is Spectrum West, where today we'll meet a young magician who travels the country amazing audiences with mysterious and wow-inspiring skill. He brings that cleverness to the Heidi Center for two nights of great foodoo and voodoo. Dinner show's just waiting to make it the perfect date. Mr. Jim Oliver is here to share a delightful conversation with an experienced theater person, Mary Cutler, directing the next unique play at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And Jim relays other community theater dates as well. Saturday marks the start of the Junior Nationals Curling Tournament in Two Harbors, Minnesota, where the Eau Claire Curling Club will be well represented. We slipped in for a chat on the ice with two of the four participants, Jenna Burcheski, a UW Eau Claire senior, and Charlie Thompson in his second year at Memorial High School. To begin our second program of the new year, here comes an example of having a will and then paving the way. Since 2010, when a corps of enthusiastic artists decided starting a local gallery in Amory, Wisconsin, made common and fiscal sense, the Art Z Gallery, that's A-R-T-Z, has become everything a gallery should and can be, including a civic center where people come together for enjoyment and with purpose. Art has been a part of Julie Adams' life for many years, and the Art Z Gallery is a hangout, and her work gets hung up. The gallery changes focus each month, and January is wild and wonderful.
This December and November were our best months ever in our 8.5 years.
No kidding.
Good for you. People are finding out about us more and word of mouth, and we have a lot more inventory and different varieties of things in here.
Well, for those who haven't traveled to Amory for a tour of the gallery, let's refresh some memories about it. There are now 17 artists involved today. How large was the group back in 2010 when it all began?
Probably more like 10. A lot of members of the gallery were also Earth Arts members, so we had kind of a connection before. I didn't start right away. I kind of thought, oh, a gallery in Amory, how's that going to go? But I did volunteer and help painting and getting the place organized. Mm-hmm. That's my purpose in life.
So how did you guys walk before you ran? Was it kind of a sparse place at the beginning, or did you hit the ground running, or what happened?
I don't think it was sparse. I mean, we don't want it to be crowded, and that's why we like having the space. But we always seem to make it work. I mean, we built some temporary walls. We have furniture. We're gradually adding more, you know, jewelry cases and cupboards and shelving and that kind of thing. I think we just work with what we've got, and it's working really well.
I think you've done a wonderful job. As you know, I've been there, and I think it's very well appointed. It's very comfortable.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's got the high ceilings and the tin ceiling and an old store front. It had been a drugstore, a hardware store, a grocery store. And we're just glad we're here, and people are glad that we're here.
Yeah. Owned and operated by the member artists. What about new members? Are you always looking to grow, or are you set?
Well, we have kind of a process. We have our monthly featured artists, which are sometimes guests and sometimes members. You know, you need to get juried in to be a guest, and then we get you into a time slot for a month. After that, if we have room, there's more about wall space than small things. If we have room for another wall artist and your work has gone well in your monthly show, yeah, then we would take on new members.
Okay.
And we have what we call long-term guests, too. You know, things that sell, like jewelry and pottery, that are here all the time, but or maybe for a longer period of time.
Talk about the arts community in and around Amory. I mean, we talk about it fairly often because you and the Northern Lakes Center and others always seem to be presenting something and are nice enough to let us know about it. It's fairly vibrant around Amory, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I guess it's nice to have more than one gallery in a town or in the area. There's also the Farm Table. They have a new gallery space. We have a new Frederick Gallery that's only about a half hour north of here. And then there's one in Balsam Lake.
Huh.
again, a lot of us are connected through the Earth Art. That's a good way to communicate and have events and get people to participate. It's like you put up a gallery and the artists come out of the woodwork and yeah. They just show up. People don't realize how many artists there are really everywhere. It's not like they're only in certain areas like the Twin Cities.
Does Earth Arts have both a spring and a fall tour?
We have the spring art tour, first weekend in May, and then we have been having a little theme show in the fall, you know, one weekend kind of thing. So art tour has really gotten to be popular, and people get around and see everyone's studios.
Art tours in general are popular. They're springing up all over the place. So
that was the main reason I joined Earth Arts, because I was going to a lot of these art tours down Mineral Point, Spring Green, and that area.
So I don't want to hear from anybody about not having something to do on the weekends.
No.
We're on the phone with Julie Adams. She's a member of the Art Z Gallery in Amory. Their January exhibit is Wild and Wonderful, and she also hosts a painting class that we're going to get to in a moment. First, Julie, let's talk a bit about you. You're a painter. Is that a lifelong passion? And how has painting added dimensions to your life? And what kind of media do you paint with?
Well, that is also ever-changing. I was an art teacher for 27 years.
Wow. So
I did a little bit of everything, pottery, printmaking, and then would take summer workshops, mostly in watercolor. So I did watercolor for about 35 years.
Okay.
And then started getting some ink, some collage. So now I've moved to mostly acrylic ink, which is like watercolor, only it's permanent. Collage, and also using more found objects and fabric and metal and wire and wood.
You do it all.
I do it all, and it changes. I don't want to just keep doing the same thing over and over.
But you are hosting a painting class on Saturday, the 19th?
Yes. So in my class, I'm going to share the techniques that I use for kind of a semi-abstract landscape. So it'll be acrylic ink and collage on canvas. And it's just a one-day class, but we should be able to get two paintings at least mostly done.
Mm-hmm. As I alluded, the January exhibit is called Wild and Wonderful. Those are two words that really make us want to know more. So satisfy our curiosity on what makes it wild and what makes it wonderful.
Well, it's up to the interpretation of the artist. What we did was invite our past guest artists from the year, the gallery members, and some of the wild things are children holding hands jumping off of a dock. Oil painting by Patricia Duncan. It might be the style of painting, like going wild with paint and just letting your inhibitions go crazy. And there are wildlife. We have a wild hare, a Sumatran tiger, lots of birds, eagles. I noticed a couple of watercolors by Paul Ullman. He's amazing. He's expressing the power of nature at Lake Superior. He has one, and then one of a lake. And with a dramatic sky, he's very good. He's local, but he's like the best painter I've ever seen. The wonderful would be just amazing things like elephants. Elephant made all out of colorful dots. There must be thousands of dots in this little painting with a sunset. Or some people are expressing a place they've been and an experience that they're remembering, like a weekend in Venice.
You're doing a great job of making us imagine what it is. I love theater of the mind on radio. People are now closing their eyes and they're trying to imagine an elephant out of thousands of dots.
I know.
So now they have to see it to believe it. As I speak here about it being radio, please, if you can, provide our imaginations with an idea of what John Kamrath creates.
John is also an amazing artist. He has made, it's called structures. They're all houses. But they're kind of a block house, almost like what you'd see in a Monopoly game, in colors like that, but of all different sizes, all the way from 1 inch up to 1.5 feet tall. He has made them out of clay, but in a complicated process that looks like they're made out of wood. And it's just like you can't tell how they're made. You have to touch them, and he has a sign, please touch, so that's kind of fun. And he has some metal armatures, almost like scaffolding, he calls it, that holds up some of them, so some of them are taller. So it's very fun, it's whimsical, it's childlike, but very creative, never seen anything like it before. He has been a teacher and a carpenter, and he also makes really large outdoor sculptures in the Twin Cities area.
Okay. Well, again, you've done a wonderful job of making us want to see this. Way to go.
Okay, good.
All right, it's called
Thank
the Art
Zine. Being interested in us.
Oh, how can we not be interested in you guys? It's called the Art Z, that's A-R-T-Z Gallery in Amory. You have a website?
Yes, it is www.artzgallery.org.
.org. And the physical directions, where in Amory is the gallery located?
Well, we're almost in the middle of town. We're right on the main, it's not Main Street, it's Keller Avenue, but it's also Highway 46. You know, it's not that big of a town. It's between the lakes and the river, so you really can't miss it.
Uh-huh.
It's great big with awnings, and we've got a big sign. And
okay, good.
We're right next to Chep's Drugstore and Ice Cream, Ellie's Ice Cream.
Oh, well, there you go.
Bring your ice cream cone in.
That's all we needed to know. Julie Adams, thanks, and keep in touch with us here on WPR, will you?
We will. Thank you.
Amory, Wisconsin, a bit northeast of the Twin Cities, south of Highway 8 on 46, through which the Apple River flows. Coming up, a delicious magic show comes to Chippewa Falls, and Hudson's Phipps Center rehearses a unique black box play. And next, curling, the sport, and young people doing very well at it. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, dedicated to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process with welcoming facilities. Located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. Little Diana Krall in the background here. Curling is just one of the sports at which West Wisconsinites often excel, one in which young participants do very well indeed. Beginning Saturday, Two Harbors, Minnesota is the site of the 2019 Junior National Tournament. Four members of the Eau Claire Curling Club have qualified with their teams. We were able to find 50% of them available to chat near the ice earlier this week. Jenna Burcheski is a senior at UW-Eau Claire. Her team is the current junior women's national champion. And Charlie Thompson, just a high school sophomore at Eau Claire Memorial, skip of his Eau Claire-based team. Well, you guys are still young, but to be as good as you are, you had to start at an even younger age. So tell me about the beginning of curling for you, what you remember about your fascination for the sport.
So I'm a third generation curler, and my dad had me on the ice from the moment I could walk. And my earliest memory of curling was hating it. It was horrible. But, you know, after coming back time and time again, because my dad just brought me back to our junior curling program, I ended up falling in love with it and just, you know, kind of got a little bit of a competitive aspect of it, competitive feel, and as soon as I got a taste of that competitive side, I was hooked.
How about you, Charlie?
The earliest memories I have came when I was about 8 or 9 when I came out on my dad's request, but my lock screen on my phone is a picture of me when I'm about 3 trying to push one of the giant rocks down the sheet. You could say I started at age 3, but not quite accurate. My first real memory is when I was around 8 years old, the 2010 Olympic team, which was skipped by John Schuster, of course, the gold medalist from 2018's Olympics.
You say, of course, like I know that, but I don't know that.
So he and his team were down here doing a little fundraiser, so you and 3 other people could challenge the Olympians to an end of curling. And 60-pound, 8-year-old me and 3 other people challenged them. There's a great video of me still trying to push the 42-pound rock, just sprinting down the ice and throwing it to try and get it to the other end. So I guess you consider that's my first brush with competitive curling.
This is going to sound sexist, but it's only because I don't know. Has women's curling been around as long as men's?
Yeah, absolutely. I do believe that men's curling may have gotten a little bit of a more competitive feel faster than women's curling did, but I mean, we caught right back up on the women's side, and you know, a lot of the top teams in our country and in the world, actually, are women's curlers. And, you know, they're right there. They can compete with men.
Yeah. And then somebody came up with a decision to do mixed stuff. Because there was that McFarland couple that was huge in the last Olympics, right?
The Hamiltons, yeah. Mixed doubles, it's really gained a lot of relevance recently. And Jen and I, not together, but we both competed in the national championship last year. We ended up playing some of the best curlers in the country. I'll tell you this, the amount of women that made killer shots to take us out of the game, it was a lot.
Now, most young people have professional role models or role models in their sport. Do you have those? Or do you remember as a young kid saying, I want to be just like him or I want to be just like her?
I have a lot of role models in curling that have brought me to where I am today. I can't say that there's one specific person who I've really shaped myself after. It's been, you know, a little bit of everybody, starting with my dad to different coaches that I've had, even different teammates my own age have pushed me to be a better curler. Yeah, there's so many people who have really contributed to just inspiring me to become the best that I can be.
You had a little reaction when I said role model. Why is that?
I actually kind of have a bit of a unique perspective on role models and curling. It might be taken as a little cocky or boastful, but I don't like to think about having a role model. I like to think of, I want to be as good as anyone out there. I'm conscious of the fact that I'm not, but the best players, the best abilities, that's something I can attain. So a set role model isn't really something I believe in, but set goals and abilities and accomplishments that that person may have is what I more strive for.
When you have a role model, you like that person because they have a certain kind of swagger or a style or whatever. Is there such a thing as style in curling?
Absolutely. You know, curling is known as a gentleman's sport. It's something that people really take the sportsmanship to heart. And, you know, going along with the concept of role models, one of my biggest role models was my coach, Bev Schroeder, who actually passed away earlier this year. She was resilient. She was one of the strongest women that I know. And really, that's why she was such a great role model to me, was beyond, you know, playing ability, beyond her coaching ability. It was the person that she is and, you know, just how she holds herself. She was just a really amazing person.
We are in the Eau Claire Curling Club. It's about 40 degrees, I understand, in here. And usually when people participate in a sport in cold weather, they talk about the sport warms them up. Does curling warm you up? Do you get sweaty when you're curling?
Yeah, you definitely do, especially when you're sweeping. Sweeping is something that when a lot of people come out and try the sport, they go, oh, well, this isn't that tough, this isn't really that hard. But it's really something that if you're good at it, you know how difficult it can be. I played last year. I swept more rocks than I had in my entire life. It showed. I was pretty exhausted by the end of the year.
In the Eau Claire Curling Club, we are with Jenna Burcheski and Charlie Thompson. They're headed to the Junior Nationals in Two Harbors, Minnesota. You can tell we're in the club because you can hear this dude pushing this rock, is that what they call it?
Yep. Down the ice, the sheet.
The sheet, that's it. I knew there was something I wasn't getting right. So in your sport, Olympic competition, is that like the only ultimate goal that a curler has?
You know, I think for most curlers, the Olympics is really the overall goal out of everything, an Olympic medal. But I mean, before Olympics come the world championships, the national championships, even the regional championships, you know, you got to make your way through all of those to eventually become an Olympian.
The Olympics, though, is that the mountaintop for a curler?
Yeah, you can kind of consider that the holy grail for a competitive curler. And you've seen that recently with the Schuster team getting the first gold medal in Olympic curling history for the United States. The amount of media attention and more opportunities they've gotten, it's fantastic. And that's what you want to see as a curler. That's what you want to see as someone who loves the sport. You want to see that positive media attention. You want to see that. And you get that from being an Olympic champion. You get that from being an Olympian.
And as I was preparing for this, I watched curling when the Olympics were on last. I was into it, the mountaintop and the goals. I wondered if there was anything like professional curling. So I Googled professional curling, and what you get is a whole bunch of expensive curling irons. When you, after the Olympics, is just being an Olympian curler, that's how you maintain your mountaintop, or is there something above that?
That definitely is part of maintaining the mountaintop, but really, once you have obtained that Olympic dream, most Olympic curlers do come back and they continue to play, like I said, in the national and the world championships. They travel all around the world playing in the Continental Cup and all these different events, staying on top of the world, really. You know, it's, even though you're playing in world championships versus the Olympics, it's the same teams, you know, it's the same level of competition. The only difference is the Olympic name.
And in my Google, you know, searching for professional curling, there was a whole thing, and I'm sure you've seen it if you Google yourself. It was about former NFL players who are starting to curl.
Yeah.
Jared Allen from the Vikings is trying that. So that must be like the thing to do after you retire from the NFL.
That's really interesting. At a tournament in Rice Lake over the summer, Jenna and I were actually playing together, and because Jared Allen is a bit of a sports icon around these parts, right? Minnesota Viking for years.
If you like the Vikings.
But we were looking around, and we see this huge guy, and we're like, is that Jared Allen? Mm. They had a pretty decent showing. They did a lot better than we expected. And I actually know the person coaching that team. That's John Benton. He's an Olympian himself. He's the best there is in the world. So I know that if they really stick with it, you could potentially see a Team Allen in the Olympics.
So starting Saturday, you're in the Junior Nationals. It's again at Two Harbors, Minnesota. What is the format of the tournament?
So it is a round robin followed by a playoff set. And basically it is the top eight junior women, which is considered U21, and junior men's teams in the country that will be playing for one spot at the World Championships.
You said round robin, which means you play everybody. Is there consolation to it?
There's no consolation. It basically means you need to go out there and win almost every game in order to have a shot for the World Championships. It's tough. Jenna here has probably the strongest women's team in the country. I have the number eight seed out of eight teams. So I'm really excited for Jenna. I really hope she'll be able to go. Honestly, I'm getting experience helping forge new relationships with people out there. I'm helping guide my team, and I'm hoping we can get some progress out of it.
Are there other members of your team as young as you are?
Yeah, we are coming in there as the youngest team in the whole field. We're all 16 years old.
You're defending something, right?
Yep, so we are back-to-back national champions. Hopefully, we'll be able to clench our third title, which would be awesome if we could do that. This is my last year competing in the Junior National Championships. So it would be really awesome to finish strong.
What is three things in curling? Because I know in hockey it's like a hat trick. A turkey is in what? That's in bowling.
Three wins is something your coach is happy about. Oh,
yeah. Well, come up with a title for it, because if you win, we have to. Hey, good luck, you guys. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A conversation with magician Noah Soni around the corner on Spectrum West. In the meantime, the Phipps Center in the river town of Hudson, Wisconsin, is about as busy an arts center as one will find here and anywhere, for that matter. And this week, Jim Oliver highlights a play that's about decades of letter writing, explained as only a director can. Mr. Oliver, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. 84 Charing Cross Road will be performed January the 18th through February the 3rd on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays in the Black Box Theater at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The comedy was adapted by James Roos Evans from the book by Helen Hanf. Joining us by telephone is the director of the Phipps Show, Mary Cutler. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Good to be back.
You can call me Jim if you'd like.
Thank you, sir.
just don't call me young fellow. That's the only thing I ask that you don't do.
Well, yeah.
That's the one thing that irritates me more than anything else. I've worked really hard to get to this age, and by gosh, I'm going to take credit for it.
Right. Amen.
Well, anyway, Helen Hamp's book has been adapted for the stage, for the film, for radio drama and television. So what makes it so adaptable?
That's a good one to start me off with. And it's curious because the story has seemed to last over those different media. And why is that? I think there's an element of our culture that just likes a good story, thankfully, and a good tale about people coming together and here over the written word. I believe that the story is, as they say in all the PR, a charming, sentimental tale about two people growing in respect for one another's thoughts, thinking, philosophy about life. And in this case, it's an old worldly charm that is both respected and held dear by the bookseller, Frank Doel, and by the writer, author, aficionada of antiquarian books, Helene Hanf. People have been charmed by this tale since it came out in the 80s, and they have done films and TV adaptations and radio plays, and my guess would be that it is sweet, sentimental, charming piece of theater.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you just tell me about the story? You've tiptoed around that, but what is the story about?
I've alluded to that, haven't I?
Yes, you have.
And even in my own PR, which I'm going to read here, since I'm not as facile with the words as I'd like to be, and I say, charming, bittersweet comedy based on the extraordinary true story of the remarkable relationship that developed between a vivacious New York writer and a London antiquarian bookseller. The soulmate's relationship portrayed over the course of 40 years, from 1949 to 1969, is built upon their mutual appreciation of the writings of revered thinkers and artists within the annals of humankind. You're going to see these people come from a point of new to their professions to more formidable people within both of their professions, and both of them remain interested in the goings-on within the family, within their careers. Their circles expand to other booksellers in the bookshop of Marks and Co., where the bookseller, that's his locale, the bookshop that he works for. And indeed, you'll see that those different issues in their lives come into play over these 20 years of time that they speak. Do they ever get together and talk with one another in person? No. They are not in the email, instant messaging, Facebook generation. They write letters in the New York Times obit of Helene Hanf. Talks about her being a, quote, wry epistler, unquote. And I have never seen the word epistler before.
No, that's a new one to me.
Epistle, of course, letter, you know, letter writer. So anyway, that's how they refer to her. That's the plot.
Okay.
How's that for an interesting tale? But Helene is a comedian. She's also a very sentimental woman who responds to life in her own intriguing, interesting way, almost like a stand-up comedian at times, but she's a writer. And, of course, the contrast of Frank Doel, who's a prim and proper British gentleman, raised in that era to be prim and proper and helpful and do his job the way that he's been trained to do so.
Well, we're talking to Mary Cutler, who is director of the Phipps Center for the Arts production of 84 Charing Cross Road. I was looking around at various productions of this, and it seems like the play originated with two characters, but your production is significantly more than that.
They have gotten a little further with that. When the dramatist James Roos Evans came to this text, I believe he saw the opportunity and or was trying to find the ways of establishing the environment of the bookshop and finding ways to parcel out the action of the piece so that both of those things would be accomplished through the other workers in the bookstore. Also, those people, as I said before, got involved in the correspondence. And I think that the playwright or dramatist in this case wanted to portray that this relationship that happened between bookseller and aficionada went in circles beyond. Other people got involved in the two of their appreciation for one another and their kindnesses and the way that they felt about one another. And I think that the dramatist does more of a communal look at how this relationship of caring and kindness and humor worked to form more bonds.
The play is being staged in a Black Box Theater. Now, I've been around community theater for more than 50 years. It's only been fairly recently that I've even heard the term Black Box. And now
okay. It
seems like everybody has Black Box. Talk about what is the Black Box, where did this whole thing start, and how do you stage your production in the Black Box?
We're still figuring that out between you and me okay. And all your, intimate listeners here. but, no, I'm laughing. Black Boxes have been around forever, often referred to as the experimental space or the arena theater. Those are the terms that are more in use, but it all comes down to people in that building typically refer to it as it's in the Black Box. Theater people always abbreviate the titles of plays, too, So we abbreviate theaters in our own buildings, viewing spaces anyway in our own buildings. Ages ago, millennia ago, theater used to be done in some cultures in a square. And the viewing places that were supposedly best were for the royalty, but indeed that wasn't necessarily always the case. Sometimes people around them in different angles saw a better version of the play than did the royalty. So it wasn't necessarily called a black box, but French theater history comes up with that. Being an academic in theater, I can trace its roots back to that, but I don't necessarily think that that's what you're talking about, so I'll get more to the present day. And I can't recall the first, but some experimental plays occurred in New York and at bigger theater centers in the world whereby they wanted to get rid of the proscenium restrictions, probably more in Europe first and then coming to the States. But indeed, they wanted to juice up, if you will, the way in which theater was seen and perceived. The technology, the acting styles, certainly the directing style, it has to change and adapt to this full round space. I'm glad that they're coming into usage more so because that usually means that we're looking at different styles of theater. At Charing Cross Road, I have seen done very capably at Theater in the Round. It does look at a script that wants to connect probably pretty intensely with their audience. And this show being about two people that form a relationship and how they do that and why, sure, bring it on. Let's take it to a black box and make it closer. Let's put it in their laps.
Yeah. I have some personal experience with that. I was in a show once in the round. You got such an immediate reaction from the audience that you don't necessarily get from this traditional stage.
And we tend not to do scripts that engage us as intensely as typically shows that, community theater can select as a vehicle. It's a good thing that community theaters are engaging in more experimental staging, says the professor.
I should point out that you once upon a time were a theater professor at the University of North Dakota, and then you decided you wanted to have some fun, so you came to the Twin Cities and you've been acting and directing ever
That's
since.
Right. That's right, and I've been doing it ever since.
Well, the play is 84 Charing Cross Road. It'll be performed January the 18th through February the 3rd on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays in the Black Box Theater at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. We've been talking to the director, Mary Cutler. Thanks so much for talking to us. Hope we can do it again sometime.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for the Phipps, the venue, and their season. We appreciate it.
TheFIPS.org is the gold mine online. Comedies, dramas, originals, classics, auditions, rehearsals. Jim Oliver knows what's happening and where.
The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present the dinner theater production of Murder at the Prom Friday and Saturday, and January 18th and 19th, and the 25th and the 26th at the Oxford Theater. Terms of Endearment will be staged by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday, and January 17th through the 20th in the Grand Theater. Alice in Elderland, a coming-of-age story locally written and produced, will be presented by ECWIT, that's Women in Theater, January 19th and 20th in the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will hold auditions for Caught in the Net at 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake will hold auditions for its 2019 summer season beginning at 9:30 a.m. Saturday at the UW Barron County Fine Arts Theater. The Summer Theater Company's 58th season will include the musical comedy Church Basement Ladies, the comedy Lone Star Spirits, the musical Mamma Mia, the comedy drama Lost in Yonkers, and the comedy A Gentleman and a Scholar. And auditions for the Charitable Sisterhood of the Second Trinity Victory Church will be held at 7 to 9 p.m. on Monday and Tuesday, January 21st and 22nd, at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory, presenting Wild and Wonderful, where members, artists, and guests have gone wild. Plus, structures, miniature assemblage by featured guest John Camrath. ArtZGallery.org. I wonder if there's an axiom that says, magician, fool thyself. Well, one of the best in his captivating field of magic is a young man named Noah Soni. He grew up and lives in the Twin Cities, but is heading east to the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls for two shows this weekend, Friday and Saturday night. They feature dinner, and that's great because he's very good at strolling table to table, doing the kind of magic that's most astounding, up close and right before your eyes. I sent away to a cereal company for a magic set years ago, but it never got me hooked. Tell me how Noah Soni got hooked on it, and when.
Well, just exactly the same way. When I was a kid, I got magic kits, but when I was young, I was never devoted enough to learn any magic. I kind of just thought it worked on its own. So I remember this time where I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I didn't know there was practice that needed to go to this. I thought you just put the cup over the ball and lifted the cup and it was gone. That's how I thought it worked. So I remember taking this ball, putting it underneath the cup and shaking it, and then lifting the cup up and hoping it was gone and it wouldn't disappear. It was still there.
You have to say a word, don't you? You got to say abracadabra.
Right, that was probably, I think, you know, I hadn't gone to Hogwarts yet. There was a little bit of a disconnect. Didn't fully know how it works. But one time I remember shaking this cup and the ball just happened to fall off the table, just kind of split off the edge. But I didn't know that. So when I lifted the cup and it was actually gone, that was kind of like the first moment of like, oh my gosh, magic is real. That was the start, you know?
Oh, cool.
And it was a really, really fun feeling until I looked down at the floor and saw the little red ball, because for a second I was panicking going, well, now I don't know how to bring it back. But once I realized, like, oh, it just fell on the ground, I kind of, you know, was disillusioned again. It took me a while to get back into magic. So I got my start when I was right around 16, 17 years old, and I was with my friends. We went to the Mall of America, and there was a magic shop there. Mm-hmm. We go up to this thing. There's a sign that says, free magic show. We talk to the magician, and we say, well, show us what you got. And he starts showing us the stuff, and we're sitting there like, this is going to be so dumb. This is going to be so lame. And then he starts showing us card tricks and coin tricks and mind-reading effects, and we freak out. I realized, like, oh, this isn't lame at all. This is the coolest thing ever. So every single day for the next 3 weeks, we're back in that shop. You know, we're driving to the mall. We're like, what time are we going to meet up there? We're talking with the magician. It gets to a point where he goes, look, you guys show so much. I'm just going to show you how to do a couple of things. So he starts teaching us stuff, and we start learning it, and we get pretty good. And we actually start doing sales for the shop. Like, we start demonstrating the products. And the next thing you know, I'm meeting all of the other local magicians in Minnesota, and it really becomes a community. We become a collective. All of my friends still do magic to this day, either amateur or professional. And it's it kind of became this community. So all of my friends were magicians. All of my mentors were magicians. I went to school and I paid my way through college doing magic. So it just kind of, one second I was just a teenage kid walking to a magic shop, and then 7 years later, here I am. It's my full-time career. It's my passion. It's everything.
Wow. That's a better story than I anticipated. Good for you.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Now, I don't expect you to know what things were like 40 years ago or further back, but I was thinking about magic then and magic now, and I concluded that it just might be more difficult to wow audiences today than, for instance, 40 years ago, when we did not have the special effects and we weren't surrounded by amazing technology. What do you think about that conclusion? And if I'm right, how does a guy like you adjust to the added demand for sensation? Because it's almost like we see and hear magic every day all around us.
Yeah, well, it's a strange time that we live in because technology and editing makes everything different than it is in real life. If you're watching a video, you have to ask yourself, is this actually what happened, or is this a cleverly constructed edit of what happened? That's what's so nice about magic, is like you're seeing it right before your eyes and there is no editing. There's no way that you can edit what your eyes are seeing right now. It's using things like psychology. It's using things like sleight of hand. It's using things like hours of practice to create a moment that almost looks like editing or looks impossible right before your eyes. So for me, a lot of what I do is the same type of magic that was around hundreds of years ago. You know, it's using things from these old books, 30, 40, 50 years old.
Okay.
And it still works today because it was constructed then to be a fooling thing, and it still to this day is fooling because now there is no technology in those books. You know, they didn't have cameras to do tricks with. They didn't have phones. They had a deck of cards. So now when you think about it, you're like, well, there must be some sort of technology to this. But no, it's a trick that's 50 or 60 years old, and there is no technology that would have been capable of doing this back then. So really, a lot of the methods and the effects, they hold up to the modern times. But then for me, what it is I find something in a book and I say, wow, this is 100 years old, but I love it. Or I find something that a magician is doing and I say, this is super old, but I want to do that. I take it and I say, how can I make this modern? One of my kind of taglines for my show is Noah Soni, a modern mind reader, where before people have been able to read minds and, like, you know, they've told people what they're thinking. It's been a thing for generations, ages. But I said, how do I make it modern? What do I do to make this exciting now? Okay. And so I do things like I tell somebody the PIN code to their phone. You know, somebody thinks of a name and I try to figure out who the name they're thinking of is. And these are things that, like I said, hundreds of years old, but I try to make it modern. I try to make it relevant now. In my show, I talk about the use of social media today. We talk about movies a little bit. You know, there's all these other elements that kind of bring it into the modern day. So for me, it's not trying to, you know, create an experience that I say, like, oh, I hope that this is still going to fool them compared to the old stuff. It's saying, like, okay, so this stuff fooled people back in the day. And it's not just about fooling people, but this stuff was entertaining back in the day. How do I keep it entertaining now? How do I make it relevant? Yeah. So that's what a lot of it is. It's modernizing old material.
He's a magician, a mind reader, an entertainer. His name is Noah Soni. Coming to the Heide Center, that's in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, of course, this Friday and Saturday. There are dinner shows, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep.
You can learn more about Noah. We'll give you his website in a minute. But the website for the Heide Center is cvca.net. That's the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association. Go to it and read about Noah. NoahMagic.com. That'll get you all you need to know about this guy. You brought up a deck of cards earlier. I was going to ask if there was one brand of quote-unquote magic that has stood the test of time better than all the others, like the card trick. It seems that that's kind of a staple, and if it's a staple, how does a young guy like you take it to a new level? How do I enhance this? What do you do?
I just try to learn as much as possible. I find magicians that I like and that I look up to, and I watch the material, and I say, like, what makes this so good? What resonates with me from this?
Sure.
So for me, I love Spanish card magic. That's a big thing. And Spanish card magic is all about, we're here together and we're having an experience. That's kind of the basis of their magic. This is fun. This is an experience for us. And it's a really unique thing because it's weird knowing that other cultures and around the world have different styles of magic. But Spanish is just a big one. It's almost like every single time you see a card trick, it's just a celebration. And that's one thing that I really enjoyed a lot. Guys like Juan Temeriz or Danny De Ortiz are huge influences to me when it comes to my card material. But for me, it's a lot of just learning material and practicing it over and over again, and then finding ways to make it my own, finding things that I like outside of magic, like comedy, movies, and music, and finding a way to tie that in with my card material.
So, for instance, let's just keep harping on the cards. Is there anything new under the sun? Do you devise new card tricks, or are they simply versions of something that's established?
It's a bit of both. There's this kind of saying in magic, and it's in other things as well, but it's we stand on the shoulders of giants. That basically means that there's so much material in the past that we can learn from and that we can modernize. It almost seems like there isn't anything new. But there are always new approaches to things. There's new takes on old classics. There's somebody that will come up with a new way of doing something old that's even better. For example, I do this trick where cards get shuffled face up and face down. It's called a triumph, basically. Shuffled face up and face down, and then the deck writes itself, and the cards go back in order. All of them will be face down. And it's amazing. It's so much fun. And just the other week, somebody showed me a new version of that I hadn't seen before. And I was like, yeah, that's incredible. That is such a good addition. And it was just in a book. So it's a lot of trying to find different ways of doing things, you know? So the plot might be out there. Somebody's going to find a new way to make it relevant again or change it up completely and just turn the whole thing on their head. Yeah. And that's the type of stuff that I look for.
You just brought up the shoulders of giants. That reminds me, there have been some very big feats in magic. High-profile live television, making national monuments disappear, that sort of thing. Is that good for magic? Does that say, gosh, where is there room for the little guy like me? I'm not trying to diminish what you do, but you are the guy who does it day in, day out, rather than, you know, live on CBS. Does that say, well, I guess cards aren't that impressive after that? Or what do you think about when someone does that big stuff?
Yeah, well, for me, any sort of magic being publicized is good. Okay. Anytime that there's magic on TV, there's magic on Netflix, there's magic on things like Amazon Prime or YouTube, it's good because it gets it out there and it makes people say, wow, I didn't think I liked magic. I thought it was cheesy guys in hats, but seeing this, that's new. I want to go see that. And so that's always good because that means that people will now find a show like mine and say, well, I haven't seen a magic show in a while. Let's go see what this guy does. It opens them up to a whole new avenue. And then what you have is now a fan of magic. I think it's always good. The more viewing of it and the more demand there is for magic, it's always a good thing. And it kind of goes back to what we said earlier when we talked about how people can edit down a moment on TV. You can't do that up close. And that's where the value comes into things like card tricks, because no matter what, you'll see that he's shuffling the cards right before you. You know, you'll be like, I took the cards, I dealt down, I stopped where I want, I turned over a card, and then inside the box was the same card. Like, I don't know how that works. I stopped anywhere, you know? Like, you can't diminish that moment because you saw something bigger on TV. Now it just creates a second moment for you. Somebody might be able to make the Statue of Liberty disappear. Somebody might just find your card. Either way, you're experiencing magic, and there's a certain feeling that comes along with that. And I think there's an even greater feeling when it's right before your eyes, up close.
I have to admit that I had to chuckle when I was writing a promo for the show. I started by saying, magic on the radio? Only at WPR. Maybe I'm opening up something brand new for Noah. Is any brand of magic possible on the radio, or is it all visual?
There have been magicians that have done things on the radio before and been able to create the experience of magic. And I think for me, what would be ideal is if we were in the same room right now, I would just show you exactly what it is that I do. I would try to read like certain things about the way you react to stuff. I would try to show you certain tricks. People listening will be able to get that experience because we're in the same room together. You're able to see it. When it's over the phone like this, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit more difficult sometimes.
Sure.
But there definitely is a place for magic on the radio. But it's a different thing because there's such a nice visual that goes along with magic that you don't get anywhere else, that it's always best to experience it in person. If you have the chance to go see a live magic show, take it, you know? Like, magicians like me are claiming to do impossible things. Take that opportunity. Go see that show. How often does this happen? you can go see dozens and dozens and dozens of plays, and they're different and they're distinct every time. How many chances do you get to go see a magician? How many chances do you get to see a magic show in person?
You and I are going to have to be in the same room then eventually, because I want to see this stuff. And speaking of in person, everybody has the chance to be in the same room, and it's a wonderful, beautiful room. It's called the Heide Center for the Arts, and it's in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And you'll be in the same room if you go either Friday or Saturday to see Noah Soni, magician, mind reader, entertainer. Thanks for being with us on Spectrum West and Wisconsin Public Radio. Noah, by the way, is going to be the dessert on those nights. Noah, thanks.
That was so much fun. That was so fun.
It was.
Thank you so much, Al.
Now, that's the kind of magician I want to go see. Does he enjoy life or what? It's probably a good idea to start practicing up on the line. How did he do that? I think you're going to need that. CVCA.net is the Heide website. Tickets are there. By the way, the meal is being catered by Carl's Barbecue. Wow. If you're listening Thursday, there's an open mic for poets and writers this evening at the L.A. Phillips Library in Eau Claire, 6 p.m. The sixth annual film series begins January Saturday at the Shell Lake Arts Center. Yes, January 12th. Other dates are February 2nd and March 23rd. ShellLakeArtsCenter.org. Local musicians are encouraged to submit work for the project Sawdust City Sounds, an online streaming and download platform from the library in Eau Claire. Submissions are going to be accepted only through Sunday. And remember, the deadline for submitting artwork for the 40th Arts West Juried Art Show is Monday. All right? Okay. Oh, one more. Galladay Gallery in Eau Claire continues the 2018 Back of Beyond experience with the current exhibit, Stars in a New Constellation. That's through January 15th. Coming up next week, guitarist and rock legend Randy Bachman, prior to his Pablo Center appearance, and samples from his tribute album to George Harrison, plus the Writers Guild readies a radio drama, and more, always more on Spectrum West. Thanks for the promotion, Kate, and supervision, Dean. And thank you out there for your presence in our audience. It's very much appreciated. Keep in touch with anything or anyone you'd like to hear us talk about or with. You can email us at spectrumwest@wpr.org. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. See ya.